Busy bee. As I logged on, I found myself staring at the screen in disbelief. There were 89 replies. I scrolled up and down the screen, unsure at first whether they could all possibly be in response to my request. Then I glanced around me at the other computer users in the library, desperate for one of them to look at me so that I could tell them. 89 responses to a single question. There were tales of bungee jumping for quadriplegics, of swimming, canoeing, even horseback riding with the aid of a special frame. When I watched the online video this linked to, I was a little disappointed that Will had said he couldn't stand horses. It looked ace. There was swimming with dolphins and scuba diving with supporters. There were floating chairs that would enable him to go fishing, and adapted quad bikes that would allow him to off-road. Some of them had posted photographs or videos of themselves taking part in these activities. A few of them, including Richie, had remembered my previous posts and wanted to know how Will was doing.
"This all sounds like good news. Is he feeling better?"
I typed a quick response. "Maybe, but I'm hoping this trip will really make a difference." Richie responded.
"Atta girl. If you've got the funds to sort it all out, the sky's the limit."
Scooter Girl wrote,
"Make sure you post up some pics of him in the bungee harness. Love the look on guys' faces when they're upside down."
I loved them, these quads and their caregivers, for their courage and their generosity and their imaginations. I spent 2 hours that evening writing down their suggestions, following their links to related websites that they had tried and tested, even talking to a few in the chat rooms. By the time I left, I had a destination. We would head to California, to the Four Winds Ranch, a specialist center that offered experienced help in a way that will make you forget you ever needed help, according to its website. The ranch itself, a low-slung timber building set into a forest clearing near Yosemite, had been set up by a former stuntman who refused to let his spinal injury limit the things he could do, and the online visitor's book was full of happy and grateful holidaymakers who swore that he had changed the way they felt about their disabilities and themselves. At least 6 of the chat room users had been there, and all said it had turned their lives around. It was wheelchair-friendly, but with all the facilities you would expect from a luxury hotel. There were outside sunken baths with discreet hoists and specialist masseurs. There was trained medical help on-site, and a cinema with spaces for wheelchairs beside the normal seats. There was an accessible outdoor hot tub where you could sit and stare up at the stars. We would spend a week there, and then a few days on the coast at a hotel complex where Will could swim and get a good look at the rugged coastline. Best of all, I had found a climax to the holiday that Will would never forget. A skydive with the help of parachute instructors who were trained in helping quads jump. They had special equipment that would strap Will to them. Apparently the most important thing was securing their legs so that their knees didn't fly up and bash them in the face. I would show him the hotel brochure, but I wasn't going to tell him about this. I was just going to turn up there with him and then watch him do it. For those few precious minutes, Will would be weightless and free. He would escape the dreaded chair. He would escape gravity. I printed out all the information and kept that one sheet at the top. Whenever I looked at it, I felt a germ of excitement building, both at the thought of my first ever long-haul trip and at the thought that this might just be it. This might be the thing that would change Will's mind. I showed Nathan the next morning, the two of us stooping furtively over our coffees in the kitchen, as if we were doing something properly clandestine. He flicked through the papers that I'd printed out. I've spoken to other quads about the skydiving. There's no medical reason he can't do it. And the bungee jumping. They have special harnesses to relieve any potential pressure points on his spine. I studied his face anxiously. I knew Nathan didn't rate my capabilities when it came to Will's medical well-being. It was important to me that he was happy with what I'd planned. The place here has everything we might need. They say if we call ahead and bring a doctor's prescription, they can even get any generic drugs that we might need, so that there's no chance of us running out. He frowned.
Looks good, he said finally. You did a great job.
You think he'll like it?
He shrugged. I haven't got a clue. But,
he handed me the papers.
You've surprised us so far, Lou.
His smile was a sly thing, breaking in from the side of his face.
No reason you couldn't do it again.
I showed Mrs. Traynor before I left for the evening. She had just pulled into the drive in her car, and I hesitated out of sight of Will's window before I approached her. I know this is expensive, I said, but I think it looks amazing. I really think Will could have the time of his life. If you know what I mean. She glanced through it all in silence, and then studied the figures that I'd compiled. I'll pay for myself if you like, for my board and lodging. I don't want anyone thinking...
It's fine, she said, cutting me off. Do what you have to do. If you think you can get him to go, then just book it.
I understood what she was saying. There was no time for anything else.
Do you think you can persuade him? She said.
Well, if I make out that it's... I swallowed. Partly for my benefit. He thinks I've never done enough with my life. He keeps telling me I should travel, that I should do things. She looked at me very carefully.
She nodded. Yes, that sounds like Will.
She handed back the paperwork. I took a breath, and then to my surprise I found that I couldn't speak. I swallowed hard, twice. What you said before, I never meant... Will's happiness is important to me. She didn't seem to want to wait for me to speak. She ducked her head, her slim fingers reaching for the chain around her neck.
Yes. Well, I'd better go in. I'll see you tomorrow. Let me know what he says.
I didn't go back to Patrick's that evening. I had meant to, but something led me away from the industrial park, and instead I crossed the road and boarded the bus that led toward home. I walked the 180 steps to our house and let myself in. It was a warm evening, and all the windows were open in an attempt to catch the breeze. Mum was cooking, singing away in the kitchen. Dad was on the sofa with a mug of tea. Granddad napping in his chair, his head lolling to one side. Thomas was carefully drawing in black felt tip on his shoes. I said hello and walked past them, wondering how it could feel so swiftly as if I didn't quite belong here anymore. Trina was working in my room. I knocked on the door and walked in to find her at the desk, hunched over a pile of textbooks, glasses that I didn't recognize perched on her nose. It was strange to see her surrounded by the things I'd chosen for myself, with Thomas's pictures already obscuring the walls I'd painted so carefully, his pen drawing still scrawled over the corner of my blind. I had to gather my thoughts so that I didn't feel instinctively resentful. She glanced over her shoulder at me.
"Does Mum want me?" she said. She looked up at the clock.
I thought she was going to do Thomas's tea.
She is. He's having fish fingers.
She looked at me, then removed the glasses.
You okay? You look like shit.
So do you.
I know. I went on this stupid detox diet. It's given me hives.
She reached her hand up to her chin.
You don't need to diet.
Yeah, well, there's this bloke I like in accountancy too. I thought I might start making the effort.
Huge hives all over your face is always a good look, right?
I sat down on the bed. It was my duvet cover. I'd known Patrick would hate it with its crazy geometric pattern. I was surprised Katrina didn't. She closed her book and leaned back in her chair.
So, what's going on?
I bit my lip until she asked me again.
Treen, do you think I could retrain?
Retrain? As what?
I don't know. Something to do with fashion, design, or maybe just tailoring.
Well, there are definitely courses. I'm pretty sure my uni has one. I could look it up if you want.
But would they take people like me? People who don't have qualifications?
She threw her pen up in the air and caught it.
Oh, they love mature students. Especially mature students with a proven work ethic. You might have to do a conversion course, but I don't see why not.
Why? What's going on?
I don't know. It's just something Will said a while back. About
what I should do with my life.
And?
And I keep thinking, maybe it's time I did what you're doing. Now that Dad can support himself again, maybe you're not the only one capable of making something of herself.
You'd have to pay.
I know, I've been saving.
I think it's probably a bit more than you've managed to save.
I could apply for a grant, or maybe a loan, and I've got enough to see me through for a bit. I met this MP woman who said she has links to some agency that could help me. She gave me her card.
Hang on, Katrina said, swiveling on her chair. I don't really get this. I thought you wanted to stay with Will. I thought the whole point of this was that you wanted to keep him alive and keep working with him.
I do, but... I stared up at the ceiling.
But what?
It's complicated. So's quantitative easing, but I still get that it means printing money. She rose from her chair and walked over to shut the bedroom door. She lowered her voice so that nobody outside could possibly hear.
You think you're going to lose? You think he's going to...
No, I said hurriedly.
Well, I hope not. I've got plans, big plans. I'll show you in a bit.
But? I stretched my arms above me, twisting my fingers together.
But I like Will. A lot.
She studied me. She was wearing her thinking face. There is nothing more terrifying than my sister's thinking face when it's trained directly on you.
Oh, shit. Don't.
So this is interesting, she said.
I know.
I dropped my arms.
You want a job so that...
It's what the other quads tell me, the ones who I talk to on the message boards. You can't be both. You can't be caregiver and...
I lifted my hands to cover my face. I could feel her eyes on me.
Does he know?
No.
I'm not sure I know. I threw myself down on her bed, face first. It smelled of Thomas, underlaid with a faint hint of Marmite. I don't know what I think, All I know is that most of the time I'd rather be with him than anyone else I know.
Including Patrick. And there it was, out there. The truth that I could barely admit to myself. I felt my cheeks flood with colour.
Yes, I said into the duvet. Sometimes, yes.
Fuck, she said after a minute. And I thought I liked to make my life complicated. She lay down beside me on the bed, and we stared up at the ceiling. Downstairs we could hear Grandad whistling tunelessly, accompanied by the whine and clunk of Thomas driving some remote-controlled vehicle backward and forward into a piece of skirting. For some unexplained reason, my eyes filled with tears. After a minute, I felt my sister's arms snake around me.
"You fucking madwoman," she said, and we both began to laugh.
"Don't worry," I said, wiping at my face. "I'm not going to do anything stupid."
"Good. Because the more I think about this, the more I think it's about the intensity of the situation. It's not real. It's about the drama."
"What?"
"Well, this is actual life or death, after all. And you're locked into this man's life every day, locked into his weird secret. That's got to create a kind of false intimacy.
Either that or you're getting some weird Florence Nightingale complex."
"Believe me, that is definitely not it." We lay there, staring at the ceiling.
"But it is a bit mad, thinking about loving someone who can't, you know, love you back. Maybe this is just a panic reaction to the fact that you and Patrick have finally moved in together."
"I know. You're right."
"And you two have been together a long time. You're bound to get crushes on other people."
"Especially while Patrick's obsessed with being Marathon Man."
"And you might go off Will again. I mean, I remember when you thought he was an ass."
"I still do sometimes."
My sister reached for a tissue and dabbed at my eyes. Then she thumbed at something on my cheek.
"All that said, the college idea is good. Because, let's be blunt, whether it all goes tits up with Will or whether it doesn't, you're still going to need a proper job. You're not going to want to be a caregiver forever."
"It's not going to go tits up, as you call it, with Will. He's going to be okay."
"Sure he is."
Mum was calling Thomas. We could hear her singing it beneath us in the kitchen.
"Thomas! Tom, 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 Thomas!"
Trina sighed and rubbed at her eyes.
"You going back to Patrick's tonight?"
"Yes."
"You want to grab a quick drink at the Spotted Dog and show me these plans, then? I'll see if Mum will put Thomas to bed for me."
"Come on, you can treat me, seeing as you're now loaded enough to go to college." It was 9:45 by the time I got back to Patrick's. My holiday plans, astonishingly, had met with Katrina's complete approval. She hadn't even done her usual thing of adding, "Yes, but it would be even better if you..." There'd been a point where I wondered if she was doing it just to be nice, because I was obviously going a bit nuts. But she kept saying things like, "Wow, I can't believe you found this. You've got to take lots of pictures of him bungee jumping." And, "Imagine his face when you tell him about the skydiving. It's going to be brilliant." Anyone watching us at the pub might have thought that we were two friends who actually really quite liked each other. Still mulling this over, I let myself in quietly. The flat was dark from outside, and I wondered if Patrick was having an early night as part of his intensive training. I dropped my bag on the floor in the hall and pushed at the living room door, thinking as I did so that it was nice of him to have left a light on for me. And then I saw him.
He was sitting at a table laid with two places, a candle flickering between them. As I closed the door behind me, he stood up. The candle was burned halfway down to the base.
"I'm sorry," he said.
I stared at him.
"I was an idiot. You're right. This job of yours is only for 6 months, and I've been behaving like a child. I should be proud that you're doing something so worthwhile and taking it all so seriously. I was just a bit thrown. So I'm sorry. Really."
He held out his hand. I took it. "It's good that you're trying to help him. It's admirable."
"Thank you."
I squeezed his hand. When he spoke again, it was after a short breath, as if he'd successfully managed some pre-rehearsed speech.
"I've made supper. I'm afraid it's salad again."
He reached past me into the fridge and pulled out two plates.
"I promise we'll go somewhere for a blowout meal once the Viking's over. Or maybe once I'm onto carb loading. I just..."
He blew out his cheeks.
"I guess I haven't been able to think about much else lately. I guess that's been part of the problem. And you're right, there's no reason you should follow me about. It's my thing. You have every right to work instead."
"Patrick," I said.
"I don't want to argue with you, Lou. Forgive me?"
His eyes were anxious, and he smelled of cologne. Those two facts descended upon me slowly, like a weight.
"Sit down anyway," he said. "Let's eat, and then, I don't know, enjoy ourselves. Talk about something else. Not running."
He forced a laugh. I sat down and looked at the table. Then I smiled.
"This is really nice," I said.
Patrick could do 101 things with turkey breast. We ate the green salad, the pasta salad, the seafood salad, and an exotic fruit salad that he'd prepared for pudding, and I drank wine while he stuck to mineral water. It took us a while, but we did begin to relax. There, in front of me, was a Patrick I hadn't seen for some time. He was funny, attentive. He policed himself rigidly so that he didn't say anything about running or marathons, and laughed whenever he caught the conversation veering in that direction. I felt his feet meet mine under the table, and our legs entwine. And slowly I felt something that had felt tight and uncomfortable begin to ease in my chest. My sister was right. My life had become strange and disconnected from everyone I knew. Will's plight and his secrets had swamped me. I had to make sure that I didn't lose sight of the rest of me. I began to feel guilty about the conversation I'd had earlier with my sister. Patrick wouldn't let me get up, not even to help him clear the dishes. At 11:15, he rose and moved the plates and bowls to the kitchenette and began to load the dishwasher. I sat, listening to him as he talked to me through the little doorway. I was rubbing at the point where my neck met my shoulder, trying to release some of the knots that seemed to be firmly embedded there. I closed my eyes, trying to relax into it, so that it was a few minutes before I realized the conversation had stopped. I opened my eyes. Patrick was standing, holding my holiday folder. He held up several pieces of paper.
"What's all this?"
"It's the trip. The one I told you about." I watched him flick through the paperwork I'd shown my sister, taking in the itinerary, the pictures, the California beach.
"I thought..."
His voice, when it emerged, sounded strangely strangled.
"I thought you were talking about Lourdes."
"What?"
or, I don't know, Stoke Mandeville or somewhere.
I thought when you said you couldn't come because you had to help him, it was actual work. Physio or faith healing or something.
This looks like...
He shook his head disbelievingly.
This looks like the holiday of a lifetime.
Well, it kind of is. But not for me. For him.
Patrick grimaced.
No, he said, shaking his head. You wouldn't enjoy this at all. Hot tubs under the stars, swimming with dolphins. Oh, look, 5-star luxury and 24-hour room service.
He looked up at me.
This isn't a work trip. This is a bloody honeymoon.
Don't be ridiculous.
But this is. You really expect me to just sit here while you swan off with another man on a holiday like this?
His caregiver is coming too.
Oh yes, Nathan. That makes it all right then.
Patrick, come on, it's complicated.
So explain it to me.
He thrust the papers toward me.
Explain this to me, Lou. Explain it in a way that I can possibly understand.
It matters to me that Will wants to live, that he sees good things in his future.
And those good things would include you.
That's not fair.
Look, have I ever asked you to stop doing the job you love? My job doesn't involve hot tubs with strange men.
Well, I don't mind if it does.
You can have hot tubs with strange men as often as you like. There.
I tried to smile, hoping he would too. But he wasn't having any of it.
How would you feel, Lou? How would you feel if I said I was going to some keep fit convention with, I don't know, Leanne from the Terrors because she needed cheering up?
Cheering up?
I thought of Leanne with her flicky blonde hair and her perfect legs, and I wondered absently why he'd thought of her name first. And then how would you feel if I said she and I were going to eat out together all the time, and maybe sit in a hot tub or go on days out together? In some destination 6,000 miles away, just because she'd been a bit down. That really wouldn't bother you?
He's not a bit down, Pat. He wants to kill himself. He wants to take himself off to Dignitas and end his own bloody life.
I could hear my blood thumping in my ears. And you can't turn it around like this. You were the one who called Will a cripple. You were the one who made out he couldn't possibly be a threat to you. The perfect boss, you said. Someone not even worth worrying about.
He put the folder back down on the table.
Well, Lou, I'm worrying now.
I sank my face into my hands and let it rest there for a minute.
Out in the corridor I heard a fire door swing and the voices of people swallowed up as a door was unlocked and closed behind them.
Patrick slid his hand slowly backward and forward along the edge of the table. A little muscle worked in his jaw.
You know how this feels, Lou?
It feels like I might be running,
but I feel like I'm permanently just a little bit behind the rest of the field. I feel like...
He took a deep breath, as if he were trying to compose himself.
I feel like there's something bad around the bend, and everyone else seems to know what it is except me.
He lifted his eyes to mine.
I don't think I'm being unreasonable, but I don't want you to go. I don't care if you don't want to do the Viking, but I don't want you to go on this holiday with him.
But I...
Nearly 7 years we've been together, and you've known this man, had this job for 5 months. 5 months! If you go with him now, you're telling me something about our relationship, about how you feel about us.
It doesn't have to say anything about us, I protested.
It does if I can say all this and you're still going to go.
The little flat seemed so still around us. He was looking at me with an expression I'd never seen before. When my voice emerged, it did so as a whisper. "But he needs me." I realized almost as soon as I said it, heard the words and how they twisted and regrouped in the air. Knew already how I would have felt if he'd said the same to me. He swallowed, shook his head a little, as if he were having trouble taking in what I said. His hand came to rest on the side of the table, and then he looked up at me.
"Whatever I say isn't going to make a difference, is it?"
That was the thing about Patrick. He always was smarter than I gave him credit for. "Patrick, I..." He closed his eyes, just for a moment, and then he turned and walked out of the living room, leaving the last of the dirty dishes on the sideboard.
Chapter 21 Stephen. The girl moved in at the weekend. Will didn't say anything to Camilla or me, but I walked into the annex on Saturday morning still in my pajamas to see if Will needed any help, as Nathan was delayed, and there she was, walking up the hallway with a bowl full of cereal in one hand and the newspaper in the other. She blushed when she saw me. I don't know why. I was wearing my dressing gown, all perfectly decent. I remember thinking afterwards that there had been a time when it had been perfectly normal to find pretty young things creeping out of Will's bedroom in the morning. "Just bringing Will his post," I said, waving it.
"He's not up yet. Do you want me to give him a shout?"
Her hand went to her chest, shielding herself with a newspaper. She was wearing a Minnie Mouse T-shirt and the kind of embroidered trousers you used to see Chinese women wearing in Hong Kong.
"No, no, not if he's sleeping. Let him rest."
When I told Camilla, I thought she'd be pleased. She had been so wretchedly cross about the girl moving in with her boyfriend, after all. But she just looked a bit surprised, and then adopted that tense expression, which meant she was already imagining all sorts of possible and undesirable consequences. She didn't say as much, but I was pretty sure she was not keen on Louisa Clark. That said, I didn't know who it was Camilla approved of these days. Her default setting seemed to be stuck on disapprove. We never got to the bottom of what had prompted Louisa to stay. Will just said, "Family issues." But she was a busy little thing. When she wasn't looking after Will, she was dashing around, cleaning and washing, whizzing backwards and forwards to the travel agents and to the library. I would have known her anywhere in town because she was so conspicuous. She wore the brightest coloured clothing of anyone I'd seen outside the tropics, little jewel-hued dresses and strange-looking shoes. I would have said to Camilla that she brightened the place up, but I couldn't make that sort of remark to Camilla any more. Will had apparently told her that she could use his computer, but she refused, in favour of using those at the library. I don't know if she was afraid of being seen to be taking advantage, or if it was because she didn't want him to see whatever it was she was doing. Whichever it was, Will seemed a little happier when she was around. A couple of times I heard their conversations filtering through my open window, and I'm sure I heard Will laugh. I spoke to Bernard Clark just to make sure he was quite happy with the arrangement, and he said it was a bit tricky, as she had split up with her long-term boyfriend and all sorts of things seemed to be up in the air at their home. He also mentioned that she had applied for some conversion course to continue her education. I decided not to tell Camilla about that one. I didn't want her to think what that might mean. Will said she was into fashion and that sort of thing. She was certainly easy on the eye and had a lovely figure. But honestly, I wasn't sure who on earth would buy the kinds of things she wore. On Monday evening, she asked if Camilla and I would come with Nathan into the annex. She had laid out the table with brochures, printed timetables, insurance documents, and other things that she'd printed off the internet. There were copies for each of us, in clear plastic folders. It was all terribly organized. She wanted, she said, to present us and Will with her plans for a holiday. She had warned Camilla that she would make it sound like she was the one gleaning all the benefit, but I could still see Camilla's eyes grow a little steely as she detailed all the things she had booked for them. It was an extraordinary trip that seemed to involve all sorts of unusual activities, things I couldn't imagine Will doing even before his accident. But every time she mentioned something, whitewater rafting or bungee jumping or what have you, she would hold up a document in front of Will showing other injured young men taking part and say, "If I'm going to try all these things you keep saying I should, then you have to do them with me." I have to admit, I was secretly rather impressed by her. She was a resourceful little thing. Will listened to her, and I could see him reading the documents she laid out in front of him. "Where did you find all this information?" he said finally. She raised her eyebrows at him. "Knowledge is power, Will," she said. And my son smiled as if she had said something particularly clever. "So," Louisa said when all the questions had been asked, "we will be leaving in 8 days' time. Are you happy, Mrs. Traynor?" There was a faint air of defiance in the way she said it, as if she were daring Camilla to say no. "If that's what you all want to do, then it's quite all right by me," Camilla said. "Nathan, are you still up for it?"
"You bet."
"And Will?" We all looked at him. There was a time not that long ago when any one of these activities would have been unthinkable. There was a time when Will would have taken pleasure in saying no just to upset his mother. He had always been like that, our son, quite capable of doing the opposite of what was right simply because he didn't want to be seen to be complying in some way. I don't know where it came from, this urge to subvert. Perhaps it was what made him such a brilliant negotiator. He looked up at me, his eyes unreadable, and I felt my jaw tense. And then he looked at the girl and smiled. "Why not?" he said. "I'm quite looking forward to seeing Clark throw herself into some rapids." The girl seemed to physically deflate a little, with relief, as if she had half expected him to say no. It's funny. I admit, when she first wound her way into our lives, I was a little suspicious of her. Will, despite all his bluster, had been vulnerable. I was a little afraid that he could be manipulated. He's a wealthy young man, despite it all, and that wretched Alicia running off with his friend had made him feel about as worthless as anyone in his position could feel. But I saw the way Louisa looked at him then, a strange mixture of pride and gratitude on her face, and I was suddenly immensely glad that she was there. My son, although we never said as much, was in the most untenable of situations. Whatever it was she was doing, it seemed to be giving him just a small respite from that. There was, for a few days, a faint but definitely celebratory air in the house. Camilla seemed quietly hopeful, although she refused to admit to me that that was what it was. I knew her subtext. What did we really have to celebrate when all was said and done? I heard her on the telephone to Georgina late at night, justifying what she had agreed to. Her mother's daughter, Georgina, was already looking for any way in which Louisa might have used Will's situation to advantage herself.
"She offered to pay for herself, Georgina," Camilla said. "And, no, darling, I don't really think we have a choice. We have very little time, and Will has agreed to it, so I'm just going to hope for the best. I think you really have to do the same now."
I knew what it cost her to defend Louisa, to even be nice to her. But she tolerated that girl because she knew, as I did, that Louisa was our only chance of keeping our son even halfway happy. Louisa Clark had become, although neither of us said it, our only chance of keeping him alive. I went for a drink with Della last night. Camilla was visiting her sister, so we went for a walk down by the river on the way back. "Will's going to take a holiday," I said.
"How wonderful," she replied.
Poor Della. I could see her fighting her instinctive urge to ask me about our future, to consider how this unexpected development might affect it. But I didn't suppose she ever would. Not until this was all resolved. We walked, watching the swans, smiling at the tourists splashing around in their boats in the early evening sun, and she chatted away about how this might all be actually rather wonderful for Will, and probably showed that he was really learning to adapt to his situation. It was a sweet thing for her to say, as I knew that in some respect she might legitimately have hoped for an end to it all. It was Will's accident that had curtailed our plans for a life together after all. She must have secretly hoped that my responsibilities toward Will would one day end so that I could be free. And I walked along beside her, feeling her hand resting in the crook of my arm, listening to her sing-song voice. I couldn't tell her the truth that just a handful of us knew. That if the girl failed with her ranches and her bungee jumping and hot tubs and what have you, she would paradoxically be setting me free. Because the only way I would ever be able to leave my family was if Will decided, after all, that he was still determined to go to this infernal place in Switzerland. I knew it, and Camilla knew it, even if neither of us would admit it to ourselves. Only on my son's death would I be free to live the life of my choosing.
"Don't,"
she said, catching my expression. Dear Della, she could tell what I was thinking even when I didn't know myself.
"It's good news, Stephen, really. You never know, this might be the start of a whole new independent life for Will."
I placed my hand over hers. A braver man might have told her what I really thought. A braver man would have let her go long ago. Her, and maybe even my wife, too. "You're right," I said, forcing a smile. "Let's hope he comes back full of tales of bungee ropes or whatever horror it is the young people like to inflict upon each other." She nudged me.
"He might make you put one up in the castle."
"White water rafting in the moat," I said. "I shall file it away as a possible attraction for next summer's season." Sustained by this unlikely picture, we walked, occasionally chuckling, all the way down to the boathouse. And then Will got pneumonia.
Chapter 22. I ran into accident and emergency. I had to ask 3 times before someone pointed me in the right direction. I finally swung open the doors towards C-12, breathless and gasping. And there, in the corridor, was Nathan, sitting reading a newspaper. He looked up as I approached him. "How is he?"
"On oxygen. Stable."
"I don't understand. He was fine on Friday night. He had a bit of a cough Saturday morning, but this? What happened?" My heart was racing. I sat down for a moment, trying to catch my breath. I'd been running pretty much since I received Nathan's text message an hour earlier. He sat up and folded his newspaper.
"It's not the first time, Lou. He gets a bit of bacteria in his lungs. His cough mechanism doesn't work like it should. He goes down pretty fast. I tried to do some clearing techniques on him Saturday afternoon, but he was in too much pain. He got a fever out of nowhere. Then he got a stabbing pain in his chest. We had to call an ambulance Saturday night. Sorry. Should have called you, but Will was insistent that we shouldn't bother you."
"Shit," I said, bending over. "Shit, shit, shit. Can I go in?"
"He's pretty groggy. Not sure you'll get much out of him. And Mrs. T is with him."
I left my bag with Nathan, cleaned my hands with antibacterial lotion, then pushed at the door and entered. Will was in the middle of the hospital bed, his body covered with a blue blanket, wired up to a drip and surrounded by various intermittently bleeping machines. His face was partially obscured by an oxygen mask, and his eyes were closed. His skin looked grey, tinged with a blue whiteness that made something in me constrict. Mrs. Traynor sat next to him, one hand resting on his covered arm. She was staring, unseeing, at the wall opposite. "Mrs. Traynor," I said. She glanced up with a start. "Oh, Louisa. How's he doing?" I wanted to go and take Will's other hand, but I didn't feel like I could sit down. I hovered there by the door. There was an expression of such dejection on her face that even to be in the room felt like intruding. "A bit better. They have him on some very strong antibiotics. Is there anything I can do?" "I don't think so, no. We just have to wait. The consultant will be making his rounds in an hour or so. He'll be able to give us more information, hopefully." The world seemed to have stopped. I stood there a little longer, letting the steady beep of the machines burn a rhythm into my consciousness. "Would you like me to take over for a while, so you can have a break?" "No, I think I'll stay, actually." A bit of me was hoping that Will would hear my voice. A bit of me was hoping his eyes would open above that clear plastic mask and he would mutter, "Clark, come and sit down, for God's sake. You're making the place look untidy." But he just lay there. I wiped at my face. Would you like me to get you a drink?" Mrs. Traynor looked up. "What time is it?" 9:45. "Is it really?" She shook her head, as if she found that hard to believe. "Thank you, Louisa. That would be very kind. I seem to have been here rather a long time." I had been off on Friday, in part because the trainers insisted I was owed a day off, but mostly because there was no way I could get a passport other than by heading to London on the train and queuing up at Petit France. I'd popped by their house on Friday night on my return to show Will my spoils and to make sure his own passport was still valid. I thought he'd been a little quiet, but there'd been nothing particularly unusual in that. Some days he was in more discomfort than others. I had assumed it was one of those days. If I'm honest, my mind was so full of our travel plans that I didn't have a lot of room to think about anything else. I spent Saturday morning picking up my belongings from Patrick's house with Dad, and then I went shopping in the high street with Mum in the afternoon to pick up a swimsuit and some holiday necessities, and I stayed over at my parents' house Saturday and Sunday nights. It was a tight squeeze with Trina and Thomas there as well. On Monday morning I got up at 7, ready to be at the trainers by 8. I arrived there to find the whole place closed up, the front and back doors locked. There was no note. I stood on the front porch and rang Nathan's phone 3 times without an answer. Mrs. Traynor's phone was set to voicemail. Finally, as I sat on the steps for 45 minutes, Nathan's text arrived. "We are at County Hospital. Will has pneumonia. Ward C-12. Once I arrived at the hospital, Nathan left, and I sat outside Will's room for a further hour. I flipped through the magazines that someone had apparently left on the table in 1982, and then pulled a paperback from my bag and tried to read that, but it was impossible to concentrate. The consultant came around, but I didn't feel that I could follow him into the room while Will's mother was there. When he emerged, 15 minutes later, Mrs. Traynor came out behind him. I'm not sure if she told me simply because she had to talk to somebody, and I was the only person available, but she said in a voice thick with relief that the consultant was fairly confident that they'd got the infection under control. It had been a particularly virulent bacterial strain. It was lucky that Will had gone to the hospital when he had, or... That "or" hung in the silence between us. "So what do we do now?" I said. She shrugged. "We wait. Would you like me to get you some lunch? Or perhaps I could sit with Will while you go and get some." Just occasionally, something like understanding passed between me and Mrs. Traynor. Her face softened briefly, and without that customary rigid expression, I could see suddenly how desperately tired she looked. I think she had aged 10 years in the time that I'd been with them. "Thank you, Louisa," she said. "I would very much like to nip home and change my clothes, if you wouldn't mind staying with him. I don't really want Will to be left alone right now." After she'd gone, I went in, closing the door behind me, and sat down beside him. He seemed curiously absent, as if the Will I knew had gone on a brief trip somewhere else and left only a shell. I wondered briefly if that was how it was when people died. Then I told myself to stop thinking about death. I sat and watched the clock tick and heard the occasional murmuring voices outside and the soft squeak of shoes on the linoleum. Twice a nurse came in and checked various levels, pressed a couple of buttons, took his temperature, but still Will didn't stir. "He is okay, isn't he?" I asked her. "He's asleep," she said reassuringly. "It's probably the best thing for him right now. Try not to worry." It's an easy thing to say. But I had a lot of time to think in that hospital room. I thought about Will and the frightening speed with which he had become dangerously ill. I thought about Patrick, and the fact that even as I'd collected my things from his flat, unpeeled and rolled up my wall calendar, folded and patched the clothes I'd laid so carefully in his chest of drawers, my sadness was never the crippling thing I should have expected. I didn't feel desolate or overwhelmed, or any of the things you should feel when you split apart a love of several years. I felt quite calm. And a bit sad, and perhaps a little guilty, both at my part in the split, and at the fact that I didn't feel the things I probably should. I had sent him 2 text messages to say I was really, really sorry, and that I hoped he would do really well in the Extreme Viking, but he hadn't replied. After an hour, I leaned over, lifted the blanket from Will's arm, and there, pale brown against the white sheet, lay his hand. A cannula was tacked to the back of it with surgical tape. When I turned it over, the scars were still livid on his wrists. I wondered briefly if they would ever fade, or if he would be permanently reminded of what he had tried to do. I took his fingers gently in mine and closed my own around them. They were warm, the fingers of someone very much living. I was so oddly reassured by how they felt in my own that I kept them there, gazing at them, at the calluses that told of a life not entirely lived behind a desk, at the pink seashell nails that would always have to be trimmed by somebody else. Will's were good man's hands, attractive and even, with squared-off fingers. It was hard to look at them and believe that they held no strength, that they would never again pick something up from a table, stroke an arm, or make a fist. I traced his knuckles with my finger. Some small part of me wondered whether I should be embarrassed if Will opened his eyes at this point, but I couldn't feel it. I felt with some certainty that it was good for him to have his hand in mine. Hoping that in some way, through the barrier of his drugged sleep, he knew this too, I closed my eyes and waited. Will finally woke up shortly after 4. I was outside in the corridor, lying across the chairs reading a discarded newspaper, and I jumped when Mrs. Traynor came out to tell me. She looked a little lighter when she mentioned he was talking and that he wanted to see me. She said she was going to go downstairs and ring Mr. Traynor. And then, as if she couldn't quite help herself, she added, "Please don't tire him." "Of course not," I said. My smile was charming. "Hey," I said, peeping my head around the door. He turned his face slowly toward me. "Hey yourself." His voice was hoarse, as if he'd spent the past 36 hours not sleeping but shouting. I sat down and looked at him. His eyes flickered downward. "You want me to lift the mask for a minute?" He nodded. I took it and carefully slid it up over his head. There was a fine film of moisture where it had met his skin, and I took a tissue and wiped gently around his face. "So, how are you feeling?" "Been better." A great lump had risen, unbidden, to my throat, and I tried to swallow it. "I don't know. You'll do anything for attention, Will Traynor. I bet this was all just a..." He closed his eyes, cutting me off in mid-sentence. When he opened them again, they held a hint of an apology. "Sorry, Clark. I don't think I can do witty today." We sat, and I talked, letting my voice rattle away in the little pale green room, telling him about getting my things back from Patrick's, how much easier it had been getting my CDs out of his collection, given his insistence on a proper cataloguing system. "You okay?" he said when I'd finished. His eyes were sympathetic, like he expected it to hurt more than it actually did. "Yeah, sure," I shrugged. "It's really not so bad. I've got other things to think about anyway." Will was silent. "The thing is," he said eventually, "I'm not sure I'm going to be bungee jumping any time soon." I knew it. I had half expected this ever since I'd first received Nathan's text. But hearing the words fall from his mouth felt like a blow. "Don't worry," I said, trying to keep my voice even. "It's fine. We'll go some other time." "I'm sorry. I know you were really looking forward to it." I placed a hand on his forehead and smoothed his hair back. "Shh. Really, it's not important. Just get well." He closed his eyes with a faint wince. I knew what they said, those lines around his eyes, that resigned expression. They said there wasn't necessarily going to be another time. They said he thought he would never be well again. I stopped off at Granter House on the way back from the hospital. Will's father let me in, looking almost as tired as Mrs. Traynor did. He was carrying a battered wax jacket, as if he were just on his way out. I told him Mrs. Traynor was with Will again, and that the antibiotics were considered to be working well, but that she'd asked me to let him know that she would be spending the night at the hospital again. Why she couldn't tell him herself, I don't know. Perhaps she just had too much to think about. "How does he look?" "Bit better than this morning," I said. "He had a drink while I was there,
Oh, and he said something rude about one of the nurses.
Still his impossible self.
Yeah, still his impossible self.
Just for a moment I saw Mr. Trent.